Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 20th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Judy Wojtaszek. Today's session number is WAJ-2001-01, and it's titled Roots of the Holocaust, Telltale Signs That Were Missed. Let's listen in.
Entry is going to take longer than we've got. And secondly, we're going to be in the middle of, I think, if we get that far, in the middle of a video that we might make arrangements for you to watch the rest of afterwards, because it doesn't fit into my other presentations during the week. My name is Judy Wojtaszek. The title of this group is Roots of the Holocaust. I think I need to clarify for all of you where I fit into the picture of you are called by name. About a year and a half ago, I had read, I'm an English teacher, have been, past tense, was, I retired the 29th of May. I'm an English teacher, though, by trade. About a year and a half ago, I read in a trade magazine in our AFT paper about an international studies of the Holocaust that took place in Poland and Israel. I had the opportunity to apply for it, and I told my husband, they're taking 44 out of the United States. My chances from Little Hillman up in Minnesota are zilch. But don't ever believe that. You see something you want to attend regardless of your age, and I thought it was way too old for them to accept, regardless of your experience, regardless of where you're living, you apply for it. And you might be surprised what happens. I was called. I didn't apply initially. My husband says, you need to. I said, no, I'll never know. 2 weeks later, an application blank arrived. He had called them and asked them to send them. So maybe he wanted to get rid of me. I don't know. But I had the opportunity of spending 26 days in Poland and Israel studying the Holocaust. And we visited a number of concentration camps. And I studied for 7 days. We did that in Poland. And then I went to Israel and we studied in Jerusalem at Yad Vashem, which is the International Holocaust Center of the world. And we studied, and I mean studied, 6 hours a day. And then we sort of played the rest of the time. But after being there for 10 days, then we went up into Galilee and stayed at a kibbutz where we studied for 7 days at the Ghetto Museum and Study Center. So I came home with a suitcase full of material. When I came home, I said, now what am I going to do with this? I'm an English teacher. This is basically social studies. And yet the thing that intrigued me and really called me to do this is I have always taught to my students the last 5 years the novel called Night by Elie Wiesel. It's a very short novel. I had asked them to put it in the bookstore, and I didn't see it there, but the woman who's there right now said it may be back there somewhere. But I do know that there are 2 copies in the library here. You can read it in a short period of time. You can easily read it while you're here, if you're still here a day or two, because it doesn't take long. This is a biography by a Pulitzer Prize winner, or Nobel Prize winner, rather, in 1986, who writes, and he calls this The Night because this is the first book that he wrote 25 years after it happened. He could not look at what had happened to him. He was a teenager living through this period of time. And I found last fall, when I was getting ready to plan my material for the class, I found this poem by a writer in the New York paper, and he says, and it's very true, I cannot teach this book, instead I drop copies on their desks like bombs on sleeping towns and let them read. So do I again. The stench rises from the page and chokes my throat. The ghost of burning babies haunt my eyes, and that bouncing baton, that pointer of death, stabs me in the heart as it sends its mother to the blackening sky. Nothing is destroyed, the laws of science say, only changed. and this is what we're going to be looking at this week. What has changed? Why do we still have these things going on? The millions transformed into precious smoke ride the wind to fill our lungs and hearts with their cries. No, I cannot teach this book. I simply want the words to burn their comfortable souls and leave them scarred for life. And I'm hoping that some of what I share with you today will leave some kind of an impact on you, that you will later say, it's not a scar, but it's a reminder. And we need to look at some of the things that are going on. As I did this with my students, I always have them end up with a project. And I brought a couple of them. This one you can look at later. It is, to me, an awesome drawing by a 10th grade student. His feelings after seeing through the eyes and the words of Elie Wiesel what went on. You can look at it. You can pass it around. But I also had a student that wrote a poem called Armageddon. She did some artwork with it, very modernistic artwork. But here's her poem. I watched them enter in with their cold, monotonous stares. They would board with our kin. How could we be caught unawares? Their brigade had come with their distorted cross. We came to fight with our own. Then we suffered the greater loss because of the God we had known. We had to wear on our clothes a patch of a faded yellow star. That's when we found the deadly catch and were soon doomed to the cattle car. There were numbers of people who stood in the sweltering sun every day. We would have laid down if we could, had we not been loaded this way. We couldn't jump out or we'd die. The people were all high strung. Our welcome was smoke in the sky, visions of death had begun. I saw the flame shooting upwards and the stench lingering in my nose. The train had ceased moving forward and our terror greatly rose. We were beaten out of the cars by men who forced us to crawl. The last vision tugged at my heart, a dead girl holding her doll. Muffled goodbyes and stifled screams, many families broken apart. I watched tormented eyes gleam as I cried with a broken heart. He asked for my age and I replied, the seconds went by like years. Could he have known that I had lied? My mind was filled with fears. We were made to shower after running nude, our new clothes hurled at us so fast. The capos in charge were always so crude, being humane was put in the past. We were ruthlessly beaten after all the calamity for ourselves we had to fend. The next day we sought friends and family. We spoke of God and of the end. How were we to know that this night was going to affect us this bad? Weeks later, I learned of a fight between a boy and his dad. How were we to know that this night was going to affect us? I never learned what came to be of the father and his son. Death was all I could see. I knew my life was now done. I never learned what came to be of the father and his son. As I lie waiting for my grave, starvation had taken its toll. I forgot about being brave, for my heart was now darker than cold. I took my last breath and I prayed, my hands now covered with mire. Then my chest began to cave and my body thrown to the fire. This is really an interesting poem, and it means even more to me now because this young lady was a very troubled 10th grader that I had last year. She was very impacted by the book. And right now she's spending 3 years in Africa doing mission work. And she hadn't even come to church before. And I don't teach in a parochial school. It was just something that impacted her. She thought, we have to do something. Now, this brings us into the subject for today. Have to do something. You got to know about it ahead of time. What was going on? What were some of the clues ahead of time? that we could have picked up on, or they could have picked up on. And many of us say, well, this took place in... Oh, I suppose I'm not going to get this up. This took place in Germany and in Europe, and those are the people that should have known. Well, we've even found out as late as last April that our government knew many years before hundreds of thousands of people were killed over there that this was going on. But we were very, very busy with our Pacific Front. And we made a policy of not allowing Jews to immigrate into our country because that would cause further problems. So there were some hints earlier. Before I get into what was going on at that time, I did write down the names of these three books. Night is the one I first referred to, and I'm going to read you just a short excerpt from it in a minute. On Both Sides of the Wall by Ben and Vladka Mead is, and I have these with me somewhere, and I'd be glad to loan them, although this is an autographed copy from Ben and Vladka because they were our directors of our program. They lived during this time. They were fighters in the Warsaw Ghetto. And there are some really interesting stories in here. So this is also an autobiography. Then this book happened to be purchased a couple of years ago for Holden, and they really didn't use it. And there are copies over there. We're going to refer to this on Friday. This is called Betrayal. It's the German churches and the stands that they took on the Holocaust. So this one is available over there. I have some other books, a wonderful, I didn't put it up there, but it's a wonderful short child's recollection of the Holocaust. And it's delightful to read because it's the innocence the children come to from something like this. And this is a collection of poetry written by children during the Holocaust and some drawings. So any of mine, I'm not this one because I haven't read it all. I just got my hands up. Any of mine I'm willing to loan out while you're here, but this one, I'll come looking for you. Okay. I think before I go into these, I want to just read a short paragraph from The Night, or from Night by Elie Wiesel. As I said, he was a teenager at this time, and these people didn't understand what was going on. He lived in Romania, and if you start studying the history of Germany, Romania, Europe at that time, within a year, borders would move 20, 30, 40 feet, or 40 miles. And so one year you might be in Hungary, and the next day you might be in Romania, the next day you might be in the end of Germany or something. This is just the way they move. But at the time, the people that were in these communities were very strong, community-oriented people. And they believed everything their rabbi and their leaders told them. And stories were coming down that there's some terrible things going on. People are disappearing. We don't see them come back. Where are they? Why aren't they coming back? In this story, he begins out by telling you of a person called Moshe the Beetle. And Moshe was basically an instructor. He had no other job. He just enjoyed teaching the religion of the Jewish people to young people who wanted to know. And Elie did. So he made contact with them, and he started being taught, and all of a sudden, Moshe starts telling this story. He returns. He's gone for a while. Then he returns, and as he returns, it says here, several days passed, several weeks, several months. Life had returned to normal. A wind of calmness and reassurance blew through our houses. The traders were doing good business. The students lived, buried in their books, and the children played in the streets. Which suggests to you what? If they're doing good business, the kids,
okay.
Everything's just fine. One day, as I was going into the synagogue, I saw sitting on the bench near the door, Moshe the Beetle. He told a story, and that of his companions. The train full of deportees, had crossed the Hungarian frontier and on Polish territory, had been taken in charge by the Gestapo. There it had stopped. Jews had to get out and climb into lorries, and lorries were truck type, just like we load up our luggage to go down. Same thing. The lorries drove toward a forest. The Jews were made to get out. They were made to dig huge graves. And when they had finished their work, the Gestapo began theirs. Without passion, without haste, they slaughtered their prisoners. Each one had to go up to the hole and present his neck. Babies were thrown into the air and the machine gunners used them as targets. This was in the forest of Galicia, near Kolomei. How had Moshe the beetle escaped? Miraculously. He was wounded in the leg and taken for dead. Through long days and nights, Moshe went from one house to the next, telling of this story, trying to warn this community at Seged. They didn't believe him. He had lived through this, but they didn't believe it was really that serious. When the Germans moved in around the town, they weren't doing anything. It was just their presence initially. They didn't believe they were any threat. They were really nice people, just like you and me. So this is where the people that are living through this existed. Now let's look what was going on in the world at the time. In 1933, the Nazi Party came to power. Now what do you think? What do you think the Holocaust actually started? It's World War II. But what year do you think? Most people think nothing was really going on until 1940. But in 1933, the very first concentration camp was built, Dachau. At that same time, because Nazis had taken over Germany, what we ended up having was a new ideology among the Germans. And that was definitely anti-Semitism. And they taught it in the schools. In fact, one of the things, our greatest resource when we were going to school was individuals who had survived that came back and talked to us. And they would tell us their stories for hours. And they're finally getting these on tape because these people are in their 80s, many of them. And one of the ladies was telling us how she was a good student. She loved school. And if you know anything about the Jewish people, you know that the Jews feel education is important, extremely important, even to the point that most of their synagogues have an area where kids can be tutored. And this is a very important part of their culture. So the kids were studying away, and she was so proud of herself because she was a good student in school. She came to class, she sat in the front row day after day, and she loved school, she loved learning. She came to school, though, one day, and her teacher says, "You sit in the back." Now, this is not an overt, "You're a Jew, get out of here, sit in the back, you're not worthy of being in the front." It's not that kind of a statement. It's just, "Sit in the back." 2 to 3 months later, she was told, "You don't go to school. Jews are not allowed to be educated." So, when this policy first came down in 33, that's an important time. 1935, the Nuremberg Laws came about. What did they do? Who knows? Anybody? We've heard a ton of things about them, but we maybe don't know. It took away, yes.
Is that where Jews were not allowed in a lot of public facilities?
Took away, right. It took away their civil rights, all the way from not being allowed to be in the military. Now, a lot of people don't want to be in the military, but that's a very proud status to serve your country. They're no longer allowed to do this. Within a year, doctors that were Jewish were not allowed to practice anymore. And by the time, I think it was in 1936, and I didn't put it on here. In 1936, we had them all identifying themselves. No, 1938. They identified themselves. They had to identify themselves with J on their passport, so they knew right away that they were Jews, anybody that looked at it. Now, again, this isn't overt. This isn't threatening to you. If I ask my husband, when he writes out or fills out his information for the passport, to put his last name, that's normal. If I ask him to put down his nationality, we wouldn't see anything threatening about that. But it was very important because it helped and assisted them in being able to identify these people. In 1937, Buchenwald, which is a very famous concentration camp, was started. At this time also, and I'm not sure that everybody is fully aware, there were not just 6,000 or 6 million Jews killed during this time. There were 11 million people. And during this time, in 1937, they identified the gypsies, the Jehovah Witnesses, the disabled, political prisoners, and homosexuals as all threats to Germany. So what are they? They're basically on the hit list. Yes?
Is it okay to interrupt?
Oh, please do.
One piece, it's just nice to know that Germany was not isolated in its anti-Semitism.
Oh, no, I was going to show you over on the map in a few minutes. Yes, definitely.
A lot of this, we look at this and we think, oh my Lord, how could this be happening in Germany? But all this was the culmination of all of these anti-Semitic feelings
in
that were
Europe.
Just being put into political systems.
Yes, and especially, I think...
England, France, Russia...
Italy. This was particularly important because of the attitude of the Catholic Church. Germany, the attitude of the Lutheran Church. Right. Not good.
Why were Jehovah's Witnesses picked? Were they more rebellious or something?
No, they were considered, how did they put that? It was... They were the people of the book. And, you know, I thought it was kind of ironical when I had read that the first time, because that is not any different than today. They come with the word, and they come to your door and talk to you. So it's the same. But I think it was that, and they were frightened of what they would say, because they were overt. I mean, they would talk. Some of these other people sat back.
They were more vocal. Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
They were also isolated because they were genetically inferior.
Oh, it's genetically inferior. And the reason they...
Darwinian.
Yeah, and the reason gypsies were thrown in there is they had no roots. Why do you want to have somebody who's going to travel in and maybe steal everything and undermine people and then travel out? I mean, they had no grounds. And they still don't today. Many of them in Europe are just traveling around. But they were put on the list also. And of course, you didn't want any Aryan, which is the name that they used for the pure German race. You didn't want any Aryans who were handicapped or disabled or mentally handicapped anymore. You didn't want them as part of it because you want a pure, that was Hitler's idea, a pure society. And so these people were all put on. And there were 5 million of those people who were also killed. And I think we forget about them sometimes. 1938, not only did they have to have the J standing for Jewry on their passports, but they also had to register all their property. Now, that doesn't seem so bad. We register our property to get our tax statement, right? But as it goes down, after the Kristallnacht in 1939 and the ghettos were established, all property of business people is turned over to the Aryans. The Jewish people may have run them, but they didn't own them anymore. So they began to lose. In 1939, there were several things that went on. There were the ghettos. The most famous one is the Warsaw Ghetto and the Warsaw Uprising. I'm going to show you some slides later in the week on the ghettos that will show you how they had to live. And Auschwitz was also in 1939. Now, Kristallnacht, I referred to when I didn't finish that. I shouldn't jump ahead too far. Kristallnacht stands for what?
The
night of
breaking glass.
Right. And at that time, the first target were all of the synagogues. They tried to destroy the synagogues, break the windows, and so on. But then they went on to the businesses, and they broke the windows within the businesses. definitely a clear message. Probably the clearest message is being sent to these people. In 1941, 34,000 Jews were outright massacred. Now, as we went through the various camps, there was, once some of these camps were established, they kept precise records. Hitler required them to account for every person, when they entered, when they were taken care of. And those records, many of them still exist. So during this time, people were being killed in concentration camps. But this was an outright massacre of 34,000 Jews. 1942, Hitler finally admits openly that his theory is this is a final solution. We must rid our country of all of these people. And not just our country, because as by this time, he's taken over other countries. And he needs all those Jews out. All of them needed to be annihilated. See, if you go to the basic definition of the Holocaust, it is the systematic annihilation of the Jewry by Nazi Germany. Thing was, we incorporated a few other million people in that. 1943 was the large ghetto uprising in Warsaw. I can tell you some stories that Vlad and Ben told me about that. Death March from Budapest, 40,000 died on the way. 1945, Germany was defeated by the Allies. There's some other things that happened up to 1948. In 1948, what happened?
Israel
became a state. Okay, some of these, as you can see at the very beginning, are kind of subtle. Individuals in a country or off by themselves in a small community like Siget wouldn't understand what's happening to them. Before I go on, are there any questions about these? I hated to race through them.
In the book, Night there, when you talk about Moshe the Beetle, when did that occur?
This was, let's see, because he ended up going, it'd be about here.
Okay.
Yeah, this is just a fascinating book.
Did they finally start leaving him when they finally got taken away, these folks?
Actually, I don't think they believed his whole story till they arrived at Auschwitz.
Okay.
Because previous to that, they would be moved into a section in a town, and they were called ghettos. But they were moved into it, and they thought, well, this isn't so bad. We're with all of our friends, we can still practice our religion, we still have our faith. Now, this isn't so bad. This may be good for us until the war is over. Well, then they were transferred onto the cars, and they were told that they were just being deported. So they don't believe much then until they actually came. In this story, some awesome stories about people's reaction when they saw the flames coming out of the chimneys when they arrived at Auschwitz. Then they began to believe. The smell was horrendous, yes. Any other questions about it?
Yes. Yeah. What was Hitler's fear of the Jews?
Boy, there's a lot of theories about why he had this bizarre attitude.
I shouldn't just say Hitler's. Apparently, all of Europe had something that they didn't like.
I think Europe followed along on a lot of this because of what he said.
Didn't a lot of it stem from the actual depression where the Jews were seen as doing better because they were better business managers, whereas the rest of the world was suffering the economic blues?
Absolutely, part of it does, because they were even in a couple of situations. In Italy, they had to go to the Jews and borrow money. The government did. And they had the money. So it was a matter of jealousy. But Hitler is kind of a psychopath, so it's kind of... Go ahead.
I've really studied this a lot because I read Night about 20 years ago and just bothered to have
that. Oh, it does. There's no doubt about that.
One of the things that I found out is that if you start going back into the 1800s and reading the literature, it's Darwin's whole idea of the survival of the fittest really became the overarching idea of all of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times we'll call Hitler psychopathic. We're looking at that backward and we're saying that. I look at him and I say he was horrifically rational. And what he was trying to do was to create that pure, he was just taking Darwinian survival of the fittest, and he was trying to identify all of the things in his mind that would weaken European society. And everybody else was doing the same thing, but he just took it to the final solution.
And I think he took it that way because
the whole idea was this horribly, and that's where I think it gets scary, because we could buy into it so easily ourselves. And the German people did it, and I think that the Depression added to it, because then you had somebody that you could scapegoat, but then you had an ideology that you could fit into it, and we believed it in the United States. Mm-hmm. It was very powerful.
Yep.
Well, I'm going to add a thing that happened to me as a little child. My parents, and my dad was born overseas, and people in our area of the country were new immigrants. Most of them came here about 1900 and a little later. And I remember when I was a little kid, they'd speak German a lot. Most of them were German. And I remember these people in this farm area making the statement that they hated the Jews, and they pronounced J-U-D-E, Jude, in German. But anyway, they hated the Jews then as American people here in the United States, which is a kind of a, I hung it up, but I do feel it was something to do with money. Anytime anybody needed money, they had to work with Jewish people to get it. And somehow there was a heck of a resentment because it existed in the United States.
Still does.
Absolutely. One other thing, and this leads really well right into this video that I wanted to show you, because you said, other people knowing and understanding what was going on and how it flowed. But before we do that, you talked about it affecting more areas than just Germany. This map, if you have a chance later to look at, what it lists here are the extermination camps. Most of us do not realize that there were 7 camps that were designated for only killing people. That's their only function. There were other camps, like the killing sites. There were 14 of those, 9 euthanasia centers, and that's where they got rid of people that would not be... They called it mercy killing, but also they did a lot of testing at those euthanasia centers. Some real radical testing, particularly of twins, of people as far as their eyes, to see how they would react to various types of chemicals, not caring whether they were going to die, because they were going to die eventually anyway, but it gave them medical knowledge, and that's why they did it there. Then you go to the concentration camps. Most of us think of the main ones. There were 44 concentration camps, and they were not just in Germany. They're down here in Hungary, Romania, Croatia, Italy even had some, France. They were all over. Down here, we have the slave camps, and this surprised me when I started reading about it and hearing about it. The slave labor camps that Germany financed and ran. There are many of them in Africa. So it was not just little Germany. It covered everything. And you can't have camps like that in other countries without the government knowing. Any other comments on this?
The town near Buchenwald, people claimed they didn't know what was going on. Even if they did know, what could they do about it at that point?
Oh, I don't think they could do anything about it at that point. In fact, the Buchenwald camp is only like 3 miles from the town. It's very close. And they had to see things going on. They had to see the trains coming in with all the people. They had to see, even though that they put them in cattle cars, they did have bars and people were hanging out and everything else. They had to see the chimney fires and things like that. But I'm not sure that they knew what to do, nor did they want to know what was going on.
Lady in our congregation was 14 in Germany in Leipzig, and she said that they didn't want to know.
No, they were afraid to know. They had an idea, and that's another whole issue, I think. Okay, now this video some of you may have seen before. It's called The Wave. If somebody will take the black cover off the front of that, please. And it tells a story to show you how this answers the question I started with. How could this possibly happen?
Yes, I remember the wave. It was one of the most frightening classroom experiences I ever had. It all started when we were studying Nazi Germany. The people selected for extermination by the Nazis were herded into concentration camps located all over Eastern Europe. The life expectancy of prisoners in the camps were only 270 days. They were worked, starved, tortured. And when they couldn't work anymore, they were exterminated in gas chambers. Their remains were disposed of in others. In all, the Nazis exterminated over 10 million men, women, and children in these concentration camps. What you just saw took place in Germany between 1934 and 1945. The situation grew out of the aftermath of World War I. Germany had been defeated. Leadership was at a low ebb. Inflation was high. And thousands were homeless, hungry, jobless. And Hitler took advantage of the situation to establish himself and his Third Reich. We all know the rest. The attack, the killing. What resulted was the most efficient death machinery ever devised. Robert, please excuse us for boring you.
Were all Germans Nazis?
No. As a matter of fact, less than 10% of the German population belonged to the Nazi Party.
Then how come nobody tried to stop them?
They said they didn't know what was happening.
Eric, how could you kill 10 million people without somebody noticing?
Yeah, I can't.
Well, after the war, the Germans claimed they knew nothing of the concentration camps or the killing. Lori?
Eric's right. How could the Germans sit back while the Nazis slaughtered people all around them and say that they didn't know anything about it? How could they do that? How could they say that?
That was a very good question, Lori.
Thank you.
your stuff here.
Rise and fall of the Third Reich, Hitler? Are you grabbing for a degree in dictatorship?
Yeah, well, one of my students asked me a question I couldn't answer.
Oh, welcome to the club.
must obey. One, everybody must have pencils and notepaper for note-taking. Two, when asking or answering a question, you must stand at the side of your seats. And three, the first words when answering or asking a question are Mr. Ross. Brad, who was the British Prime Minister before Winston Churchill? You weren't listening. Remember? Discipline. Robert, show Brad the proper procedure for asking a question.
Mr. Ross.
That's correct. Thank you, Robert. Again, Brad?
Mr. Ross, wasn't it the Prime Minister?
No. Too slow. Much too slow. From now on, your answers are to be as short as possible. Now sit down and try it again.
Mr. Ross, Chamberlain.
Now that's the way to answer questions. Punctual. Precise. What country did Hitler invade in September of 1939? Andrea.
Mr. Ross, I don't know.
Still a good response, Andrea. Amy.
Mr. Ross, Poland.
Excellent. What was the name of Hitler's political party?
Mr. Ross, the Nazis.
Good guy. Very quick. That was the short name. What was the official name? Laurie.
The National Socialist.
Sit down and do it again. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Ross, the National Socialist German Workers' Party.
Correct. Peter, who proposed the Lend-Lease Act?
Mr. Ross, Roosevelt.
Right. Who died of the death camps?
Mr. Ross. Jews, gypsies, and homosexuals.
Who ran the death camps?
Mr. Ross. The SS.
Excellent. Tomorrow's assignment is on the board. Class dismissed.
Man, what a rush, huh? Too bad all my classes aren't like that.
Sure means taking notes.
That's for sure.
Hey, anybody in Nicholas' class to get it together like that is a genius.
You ever seen anything like that? I'm really getting into it.
We go on.
A move, a team, a cause. understand community, you have to experience it and participate in it. Now, everyone, repeat our two mottos.
Sway through discipline, sway through unity.
Now, we need a symbol for our new community. Something for members of this class only. A wave is a pattern of change. It has movement, direction, and impact. And from now on, we will be known as the wave. And this will be our salute. Robert, what is our motto?
Mr. Ross, strength through discipline, strength through community.
Very good, Robert. Remain standing, please. Now, Peter, Amy, Eric,
strength through discipline, strength through community.
Now, Brian, Andrea, Laurie, join them and repeat.
Strength through discipline, strength through community.
Louder.
Strength through discipline, strength through community. Strength through discipline, strength through community. Strength through discipline.
Contagious.
You can be a guinea pig in your own experiment, huh?
female. She can't possibly understand what the waves are about unless she's been here to see it work. Parents always think they know everything.
Who is that?
I don't know. He's not in our history class.
Now, you all have membership cards. If you turn them over, you will find that some of them have been marked with a red X. If you got a red X, you are to be monitors and will report directly to me any members who don't obey our rules. Discipline and community are meaningless without action. Now, discipline gives you the right to action. A disciplined group with a goal can take action like a well-oiled machine, approve hard work and allegiance to each other. You will learn faster and accomplish more, but only if you support one another, and only if you work together and obey the rules can you ensure the success of the way. You are all to actively recruit new members. Each new member must demonstrate knowledge of our rules and pledge strict obedience to them.
Mr. Ross, for the first time I feel like I'm part of something great.
Mr. Ross, this is like being born again.
Mr. Ross, I feel the same way.
Mr. Ross, I'm proud of the way.
Like who?
The mother.
Even the daughter, her look in her eyes. Pardon?
Yeah, she's changing.
She's changing. She's beginning to wonder. As this develops, you see how it goes and who ends up being the leader. And it's an excellent film. It really shows you how it can so suddenly happen. I don't know when else we're going to be able to run it, but I'll have to check and see the rest of it. Okay, it's quarter till, I think.
Could we do the option of doing a later lunch and finish it off?
It's fine with me if you want to do a later lunch. Do you want to? Well, if you can't, you could.
But you're just going to show the video of those who want to stay.
Yeah, I'll just show the rest of this to those who want to stay. Those that want to go to lunch, I certainly am not going to be. If you have any other questions or comments, or if you think and mull this over and you want to ask me, I'll be around. Otherwise, if you want, come tomorrow night.
I'm not going.
Why not?
Because I don't want to.
Lori, this is a very important meeting. All the new members are going to be there.
Oh, what? David, don't you think you're taking this whole thing a little bit too seriously?
No, I'm not. You're not taking it seriously enough. Look, Lori, you've always been a leader. The other kids, they've always looked up to you. You've got to be at that meeting.
That's exactly why I'm not going. Let them make up their own minds about the way. They're individuals.
I don't understand.
I can't believe how crazy everybody's gotten. David, but the wave is taking over everything.
Sure, because the wave makes sense, Laurie. It works. Everybody's on the same team. Everybody's equal.
Oh, that's terrific. Do we all score a touchdown?
You know, you're just against this thing because you're not special anymore. Because you're not the best student in the class now.
That's not true, and you know it.
I think it is true. I know how the rest of us felt listening to you and Amy always giving the right answers.
David, you're being stupid.
All right. I'm so stupid. Why don't you go find yourself a smart boyfriend?
Something you'll all regret.
I can't stop now. They'd be left hanging. They'd be confused. They wouldn't have learned a thing.
Well, let them be confused.
No, I can't do that. Now, I'm a teacher. I have responsibilities to them. I have to push them until they get the point. I'm teaching these kids the most important lesson of their lives.
Well, I hope the principal agrees with you because he just called and he wants to see you right after class tomorrow.
You're all lost. You can't be allowed to say these things. It's not important. Nobody cares what Laura's writing or what she has to say. But anybody who reads this will get the wrong idea about the way.
And this is the second article she's written.
Relax. There's always going to be people who won't believe in what we're trying to do. But if we don't watch out, those people are going to ruin it for the rest of us. Lori Saunders is a threat. She must be stopped.
Don't worry. There it is.